You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. Now, last year, two high-profile exhibitions pushed the awkward, shuffling personage of outsider art back into the limelight. Massimiliano Gioni's Encyclopedic Palace and Ralph Rugoff's Alternative Guide to the Universe. While this gesture of inclusion helped to briefly expand the scope of contemporary art and curation, both Rugoff and Gioni's conception of outsiderness derived predictably from Jean Dubuffet's and still referred to compulsive creations by amateurs, social misfits and the mentally ill. But if we discard this old and rather narrow definition of the term, something interesting can happen. Outsider art can also be used to refer to work made under conditions of institutional exclusion, when professional contemporary artists who disagree with orthodoxies both old and new find themselves pushed to the margins and are forced to fight their way back into the centre. My guest this week is Carolee Schneemann, an artist who, since the 1950s and 60s, defined her innovative multidisciplinary practice against the boundaries of what was deemed institutionally acceptable. In the 50s, she battled against an art world dominated by male chauvinism and the dictatorial edicts of Clement Greenberg. In the 60s, she pioneered a type of body-centred performance practice whose embrace of heterosexual pleasure rubbed militant second-wave feminists the wrong way. And from the 1970s to now, her embrace of orgiastic pleasure as a liberatory device continues to unsettle those who view sex essentially as a kind of violence. Earlier this week, I caught up with Carolee at Hales Gallery in London to talk about her work and current exhibition, Waterlight, Water Needle. So we're currently sitting in a kind of anteroom at Hales Gallery next to your current exhibition, Carolee, which is Waterlight, Water Needle. Mm-hmm. How has it been being over in London this time?
It's being back in London, and that's wonderful. I'm always nostalgic for London. I had a parenthetical life here in the 70s, and I have a very deep sense of a psychic containment in London. Although they've torn it apart, I've been away for about 7 years, and it's horrendous, the degree of architectural destruction that's supposed to improve the social construction here. It's a mess, it's hideous. But it's still, in essence, London. And it's very enriching.
It's interesting because I should describe for listeners who, because we're on radio, they can't see where we are. But like I say, we're in a small room. But to my left and to your right, Carolee, is a couple of images that were taken in London.
Yes.
That's right. And
yes,
there's one at the ICA and one in the apartment for someone in
my flat.
In your flat in Belsize Park.
Yeah.
What was that like? Because I mean, I'm always interested in like these amazing 70s apartments. Because of course now we live in shoeboxes. So what was it like when you were living?
It was a shoebox.
It was a shoebox, yeah.
But it was beautiful. It was on the corner of Belsize Park and Belsize Park Avenue, and a friend of mine had a flat on Belsize Park Road, and one of those. But this was a little flat right on the corner, It's a grand house, and there was a basement flat for rent that had a little hydrangea bush out the window and a tiny garden where my smuggled-in cat would be able to go out, in and out. But unfortunately, the landlords were an elderly woman and her very large son, the Goodwins. My friend recommended me to them, and it seemed everything was fine, and then I thought I should mention that I had my special trained cat with me, and they said, oh no, terribly sorry, couldn't possibly allow a cat. And then I started to cry. And that seemed to just stop everything.
Yeah.
They went into some frozen motion and said, well, perhaps just for the first month. Yes, well, we'll see what happens. 1 month. I was recovering from a kind of breakdown that many people had during the endless Vietnam War. And the endless brutalities that my country incurred then. It was a place where I was recovering. It's quite remarkable. And I still have to go and visit that little flat. Of course, the building's all painted up, and now there's a some kind of a Mercedes-Benz parked in the garden.
Yeah, naturally. So you once said, everything I've done emerges from my discipline and concerns as a painter. Could you tell me how painting became a central part of your practice?
Well, painting is, you know, my discipline, it's my history, it's my arduous entrance into the history of art. I started drawing obsessively when I was 4 years old, and you know, lots of kids do that. But these were uncanny portraits of my brother in a bassinet throwing a toy, and sequences that were almost like film flip books of ice skaters and elements in action. They're very interesting. And then by the time I am close to teenage, I don't know what painting is. I don't know what an artist is. Whatever it is, I'm being hugely discouraged by my family that this is not a good way. This is a useless, dangerous way for a young woman to go. But it's too late. And so I get, luckily, scholarships and fellowships, and I'm able to study painting and the history.
And we're also, well, behind you at the moment is a painting, or a kind of combine, from 1961. So what was the title of this piece?
Conversions.
So maybe it would be interesting to kind of trace the journey up to this point. So, I mean, you studied your BA at Bard in the 50s. And, of course, abstraction was in the air.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, what was that like for you being in that atmosphere? Because in some ways it's quite a male-orientated field. On the one hand, it was about freedom. On the other hand, it was about, you know, guys being super intelligent with other guys.
Well, it was exclusionary, even though I was there on a full scholarship. My painting teacher said, don't set your heart on art, kid, you're only a girl. And the constant message is, my boyfriends and their friends stole my art books and my brushes. They said, we need these more than you do. It was systematically exclusionary, so that there were never any woman teachers, and there was no precedence to give me a lineage. So I think this made me extremely stubborn and determined. And of course, it continued with different cultural and academic structures which would try to discourage me completely. My early actions with my body as an element of my painting constructions, I body, in 1963, that was considered narcissistic and vaguely obscene. So anything with the early use of the body was taken as something purient. Mm. And I saw this is something else I have to work against. I can't let it stop what I'm seeing as possible. And one of the things we're looking at to my left, your left, is a sequence where I'm ice skating naked in Edgerton Gardens on my partner's rug, Anthony McCall. Mm. But I'll go back to the painting construction right behind me. I always considered this a failure. It was my sort of attempt or experiment to make painting and sculpture in a direct interaction. So it was an increased density of collage with extended elements, and it includes a hanging rope at the bottom. So it's wonderful to have it here now being appreciated, because it was something that I always looked at and said, I don't know if this is something that I feel succeeds or should be kept hidden away.
And your feelings about whether or not a work succeeded or failed, was that in line with, I suppose, a desire to move into abstraction, or was it to do with formal terms? Because when I think of a piece of work that you made, which is Three Figures After Pontormo, that piece to me seems it's just on the edge of figuration, like it's being it's just staying within the world, you know.
Yeah.
And it almost seemed like that was on the precipice between concerns of figuration and just a total abstraction.
Well, yes, you're right. It's an important work, and it's a really early work. I'm studying Pontormo, so that's part of the basic perceptual discipline, and then I begin to slice through the canvas to get to the other side of some aspect of dimensionality, some other side of received art history. So it's a very interesting work because while it's referent, it's clearly, if you can see it, to the Pontormo three figures, the surfaces are sliced and cut and shaped by scratching and slicing.
Would you consider, when you were thinking of making that work, what were you trying to achieve? How did you know that it was a success or a failure once that was finished?
That's such a difficult question. Artists answer that question many different ways. Like, they get fatigued, or you can't go further, or this seems to be what it was about, even though that remains somewhat elusive because it doesn't belong to existing terms.
Was there a sense, as you were moving through the 50s and getting towards the 60s and starting with works like I Body in 1963 and moving on to Meet Joy in 1964, I mean, was there a feeling that even though your practice was centred in painting, that somehow there were things that couldn't really be expressed within that medium?
Oh yeah, and it was heartbreaking. I don't get out of university until 60 or 61. So, you know, the 50s are like a kind of aesthetic childhood. But once I'm in graduate school, I realize that painting has to be completely reconsidered for me, and I'm heartbroken. I don't want to do it, but it's demanding extended dimensionality, unpredictable forms, and live action in real space. But I'm in despair over that. I don't know how to explain that. I saw this is what has to happen. This is the inheritance of abstract expressionism and Dada and Schwitter. So there are precedents.
And I mean, those are kind of the big canonical figures in the history of art.
Yes.
But were you also, because you read a lot, and so I'm wondering, alongside these figures who are kind of influential on the artistic spectrum, what were you working with theoretically at this time? What was propelling you theoretically?
Well, I think part of what was propelling me was a not very clearly articulated sense that I had to really struggle against the inherited traditions, since they were so, because they were so systematically exclusionary, and because all my work, as I saw the direction it needed to take, was being denigrated and denied potential value. I was very fortunate in my partner, since we were very young artists together and supportive and influential for one another. So living with a musician, a composer, James Tenney, who was also struggling towards a reformation of the nature of sound, and hearing him struggle with chords of Ives over and over again on the piano, I knew that this was about persistence and insistence.
But I mean, I guess I'm thinking of figures like Freud, Jung, and Wilhelm Reich, because they film a kind of trinity of men trying to explicate sexuality for females in some ways.
Right.
And so I'm thinking, on one level you have a kind of male-orientated painterly tradition, and then you have a male-orientated explication of sexuality.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, finding yourself within that melee, was that another reason? Did that sort of galvanize you towards action?
Yeah. I had a fierce sense that I needed to take what I needed from these histories, these figurations, and to study them well. And at some point, that was a source of encouragement, even while I had to throw most of the cultural formations away, far away. It's a question for a feminist of, do you dance to the Rolling Stones under my thumb? Yeah. And then I go on and try to reassess what those hierarchies are really about, apart from the dance.
I mean, that's a good question, because I think that sort of ties into a key idea of objectification. Can you yes. work through objectification?
You have to swirl around and come out the other side, right?
Yeah.
You know what? I called it double knowledge. I was living in, and maybe that happens for you as well. My culture did not offer me authority or full participation as as a concept, as an assumption. So I always felt I was a bit of a criminal in the art world because I was taking its basic principles and running away with them and turning them into something that the culture did not really want or approve of. But the double knowledge was that I needed, this was my culture, I needed to work within these configurations and then reposition them.
And where did that, because that's quite a courageous standpoint to take. In one sense, it seems natural talking to you now, but I'm sort of thinking you, am I right in saying you were the first woman in your family to go to college?
Oh, yeah, no, I was not supposed to go to college. My father, who was, just a great guy, wonderful, devoted rural physician, very open-minded, but he refused absolutely to consider my going to college. Okay, so that was one of the shocks along the way, and they just kept happening.
And I mean, so at that point when you're up against those oppositions, okay, let's say in the 18th century, literature is filled with female characters who come up against that situation and then acquiesce to...
Or commit suicide, yes, or get killed.
Yeah, but this seems, I mean, you come up against it and you go straight through it.
I go through it with a breakdown when Tenney and I separate, and that's when I end up in London, really quite by accident. So that's like 1970. And I have to crawl out of this abyss of loss, confusion, and just kind of lostness. And London becomes my hospital, my healing place. And the little flat in Belsize Park is where I slowly begin to recover, and then meeting Antony revivifies my life and centers it again.
Because there seems to be, in your work, a lot of affirmation, and which sometimes in the art world is really difficult to push through, because there's a conservatism, I find, that runs through a lot of...
It's very prescriptive. Mm. There are movements, and if you want to... judge yourself as part of the art world, you struggle within these sometimes academic, sometimes aesthetic movements. So I always felt I wasn't really successful because I wasn't fulfilling the expectations. And then here it is, it all worked out. How amazing and wonderful.
And I mean, so when you're sort of feeling like you're being excluded or on the edges, or it's quite difficult to get... at the centre instead of being on the margins in some ways. Did performance seem to you to be more somewhere that was a bit more of an equal footing? Because I'm thinking, say, in the 60s, in opposition to, say, painting or the emergence of conceptual art, there's a strong female presence in performance. So I'm thinking of, Yvonne Rainer, Tricia Brown.
Well, we started together at the Judson Church. We were all Judson dancers then. And I'm the first painter invited to choreograph for the dancers. And it's amazing to go through the early programs and see, like, everyone is famous. Everyone has made the aesthetic difference they wished and hoped would be possible. It's quite astonishing from these little groups. And that we all knew each other and responded to one another's works through the early 60s. So when Rauschenberg, I always say, when he sold a work, he had a big party for all the artists. Well, that would be about maybe 140 people who all knew each other and centered their aesthetic activities within their grouping.
And because it was interesting, I wondered, so were you were totally aware of what was happening around you? Everyone was a community.
Yeah.
And this is jumping back a bit, but I wanted to ask about when you grew up. So you grew up in Fox Chase, Pennsylvania, and you grew up in a time of huge transition, socially, culturally, economically. Were you similarly aware of the changes that were happening around you in that period?
No, I was most concerned or aware of the ecological changes. The farms where I grew up and could ride my bike and disappear, and the farms were all being sold and cut up and turned into, at that time, modest housing. Now you have this surreal exaggeration to come back to London and see these monster buildings, dwarfing, overwhelming, and utterly disconnected to the spirit of the place.
It feels to me that your work does seem to offer a way of reconnecting with some sort of spirit.
Well, that would be splendid.
Well, because, I mean, we can frame it in terms of pleasure.
Pleasure and rage, my two deepest motivations. Mm-hmm. To work with the domestic ecstatic, the heightened pleasures of experience, and having those centered on the fulfilling aspects of work. And then the contradiction that you bring to mind is the contradiction between the solitary confirmation of dailiness as a painter. When you wake up in the morning, and if you don't have to rush to your job or something, you give yourself permission to develop a process of image investigation. And it's very solitary, it's very private. And then with performance, suddenly you have a whole audience and participants to train, schedules that are very complex. It's all public suddenly. So there was this huge declivity.
And with that in mind, how did Water Needle unfold? Because that's not such a... I mean, there's a lot of big works that happened for you in the 60s. But this... It started in 1964, didn't it, with a series of sketches, and then it developed a bit later. Could you maybe...
Was it 64 or 65? I mean, these years get very crucial to me because the changes within a year are immense. But it was after I made and realized Me Joy in Paris, that's 64, and then given the ticket to go to Venice, which was overwhelming and ecstatic, astonishing, a world where you could be completely lost in the aspect of clouds and water and an architecture that always led you away from your intention. Venice is magical in, displacing your sense of surety. And it was that sense of a loss of gravity and shifting intention that began to provoke these drawings about anti-gravitational action. So here the drawings, this work at Hales has never been shown in a context, never. So the initiating drawings, they're here, some of them, and all my work begins with drawings, anything performative or painterly. And the drawings are very interesting to me. And then we have the documentation of the work in a film that's been converted to video, and then edited as a double projection, and also documentation in large black and white photographs of the performance at the St. Mark's Church, one of the next odd connections from the St. Mark's of Venice to the St. Mark's Church in New York City.
And it's great because one of the motifs that flows through a lot of your works is rope. I mean, and it's great because we can see...
Thank you, yes.
..in the piece behind us. And I wanted to talk a bit about that because there are kind of tensions in how it's read, aren't there? And one such tension emerged in a kind of conversation you had with Irving... is it Goffman?
Oh, yes, Irving Goffman. Yes, thank you. Yeah, right, that's a good story.
Yeah.
Should I tell it?
Yeah, oh, please do. Please, I'm fine.
Well, you know
it, yeah.
All of it. Correct me if I forget some of it. It was a panel of scholars from the 20th century. What was that? A scholarly panel that was given every now and then at a university in the Midwest. And Ionesco was invited to it, and many distinguished people. And I was given some time to talk about my work up to including Her Limits, where it's almost a form of automatic drawing sustained over many hours, where I'm suspended in a tree surgeon's harness on a 3/4-inch manila rope. And I use the suspension to extend the axis of my gesture. I have crayons in my hand. And as I swing on the rope, I'm marking the space which is constructed so that I can reach the walls and the floor. And as a continuous drawing, I can start and stop and get off the rope because I work on this installation every day from... I'm in an institution. If they open their doors at 8 for the boiler man, I get up and I get on the rope at 8. If they close the place at 6, I might get down and have an evening on a mat. Mm. Up to including her limits also has to do with following the energies of Pollock into an entirely embodied gesture action. So I'm showing slides of it at this 20th Century Conference. And this very annoying man in the audience says, "I'm sorry, your description of this work is not culturally accurate. You can't have a nude woman on a rope that doesn't indicate a sadomasochistic position." So I'm saying, no, it's not like that at all. The rope requires a certain energy and strength and balance, and it's pleasurable. It's expressively pleasurable, and it should counter any aspect of sadomasochism. And this little guy is insisting in very loud, says, "There's no way that you can reconstruct these inherited principles." So I turned to Higgins and one of the organizers and said, "Can you get rid of him? You ask him, just take him out. I can't continue explaining my work." And they're all very upset and say, "No, no, no, he's very famous. He's very important. He's Goffman. He's the head of the study of sociology and psychological cultural patterns." And then Higgins, who is a dear friend but never has been an overt defender, and he's imposing, he's large, and he says, and he knows who it is, he says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Goffman, you have to understand the rope is innocent." Oh, beautiful. It changes the whole inquiry.
And I think that's one of the wonderful things about your work, is it makes us look again at maybe negative readings, so readings that have gone through one period of critique or one filter of critique, and maybe allows us to look at them in a more joyful way without the sort of accumulated guilt that comes through these sort of initial deconstructions, if that makes sense.
This is curious because I see that my work is always shameless. I don't think of that until people ask me, "Didn't you feel uncomfortable being nude, or filming yourself making love?" Or, well, no, this is not difficult. I know that I'm working against the established moral expectations, but I don't feel that I'm aggressive or... My work is angry in my political work. I'm enraged when I build the video constructions on Vietnam, on the destruction of Palestinian culture, the chaos in former Yugoslavia, and where else? I'm forgetting some of my rage points. But then that's counter-focused by pleasure. Pleasure of the body, body in the landscape, the film, Kitsch's Last Meal, that's just a domestic diary. Mm. But of course it's framed, and the cat represents to me the position of domestic intimacy and normalcy. Mm-hmm. You can't do that kind of work if your world is blowing up, and you can't use your body this way if you've been abused and molested.
And so here in Waterlight and Water Needle, we have this presentation of joy, and elsewhere there'll be different presentations of pain, I suppose, to put it simply.
Fury.
I wonder about this weightlessness, because on one level we have the weightlessness and the joyful associations of, say, the swing, or but then you have to be physically accomplished to achieve that. So what was that process like? Because I noticed in the video some people are wearing gloves. You weren't, but some people were wearing gloves.
But this is the point that you just got to that's important, is that the pleasure of the work is always in contradistinction to what's surrounding it as a destructive or negative force. So I can't go directly to a pleasurable state without really measuring what wants to destroy it or resist it. And that's where the work has its strength of purpose. It's never ironic. It's never cute. It can be funny. And humor is a very important tool for me. Often when I'm most enraged about some social situation, the way to address it is to enter it as a comedy.
And you touched on these depictions of fury, or that you feel reactions to fury, channeling that emotion into our objected in some way. And so I wanted to talk to you a bit about your multimedia works. And I suppose sometimes I find in your oeuvre that because you have these giant pieces that happened in the 70s and 60s, a lot of attention gets focused on them, but it's not as if you stopped making work then. You continue to make work right up until, obviously, until now you're still making work.
Yes, yes.
And I wonder if, like, at what point did you see the possibilities of say, media? Were you like, I can see where I can use installation, I can see where I can use multiple screens.
It's all painterly, it's about space. I could imagine water light, water needle. The sensations of the anti-gravitational properties that were so exquisite demanded and offered this structure of a network of ropes on which the figures could be suspended and in contained momentum. But as you mentioned a minute ago, some of us were wearing gloves, and what, as a painter, as a visual artist, I didn't understand was that we couldn't hang on those ropes until we built very big calluses. Those ropes were painful. Mm. That effortless momentum, that took intensive rehearsals for muscle memory, calluses, the interrelationship that we were going to be able to improvise together, given the configuration of being suspended and moving between ropes. Mm-hmm. So those physicalities that are embedded and unknowable in an action, or even just looking here when the photographer came with a boa constrictor to my Belsize flat, I don't know quite where he got that idea, but I really liked the snake, and I was not put off by the idea of entering this iconic realm of the naked female with a serpent. Hey, it really was a great big snake.
And I mean, that's kind of interesting as well, because your work seems to be read some ways in a different way with each coming decade.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's. I mean, that must be interesting, because there's some pieces that people say, well, they just sustain, and throughout time it will always be read. Well, maybe not, but some, let's say something like the Mona Lisa. This is a quite far reach, but I'm sure it applies to some contemporary art as well.
I have to try? Are you suggesting?
No. I'm saying what's wonderful about your work, and I think it's singular about contemporary art, is that it can be read, that it keeps being activated with each new decade, with each new way of seeing comes a new way of approaching something. And what I like about your work is that, yeah, this piece here, one time someone might say, well, you're just self-essentializing, you're objectifying yourself, you're holding the phallus. And later on, you're
appealing to the male gaze.
But then later on, no, you're not. You're sexually, you know, you're liberated, in control of your own sexuality.
And I'm referring to Paleolithic fragments on which there are little etched figures with serpents wrapped around her arms. It's a goddess with a serpent. So, yeah.
And I mean, is that something that you are interested in then, this push and pull between what the work may initially have been for you and what it becomes for other people?
Yes, but it's not predetermined. It's not programmatic. Many years I'll be studying Paleolithic charts, and the tremendous enriched history of sculptures and markings made by women and lost to our culture, but you know, what archaeologists in feminist theory are able to bring forward. Mm. I'll be studying archaic figurations, and then I'll be studying theories of male violence. Mm. So there's always some concern that I think has an archetypal reach for me.
And with male violence in mind, war comes in, and war and conflict mm-hmm. comes in, or patriarchal forms of domination.
But here's a place where I can mention the constancy of the rope. In Viet Flakes, there's a juxtaposition of the rope dragging a Vietnamese prisoner on a rope through the mud until he's dead, and he's attached to a tank. And then I juxtapose that with images of American Santa Claus leading a horse and carriage, holding the ropes. There's the lynching rope. There's the cowboy rope. The rope is not only innocent, but it's so flexible. It's such a malleable material. And through history, it has this functional constancy.
Viet Flakes was a piece that you made in 1960. Do you remember? Was it 65?
We can look it up. Maybe 65. I'm looking for More Than Meat Joy that has lists of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was 65. Yeah, 1965. So could you talk a bit about when you made that? Like, was that just a direct response to what you saw as injustice happening in Vietnam?
Yeah, yes.
And yeah.
At the University of Illinois, this is a story where Tenney and I had graduate grants. We met a young woman who was a poet from some place we had never heard of, Vietnam, and she told us that the American government was destroying her culture. Tenney and I decided we have to research this place, Vietnam, and little bits of information about our soldiers going there. It's all very hostile. The references to the Vietnamese, so I need to find out what were the French doing there, what did they want there, why do we care, and why is this destruction, this warfare, so imbalanced, so relentless? We've got all this heavy-duty material going in, huge numbers of draftees. The country becomes polarized because of the way we look. We could be attacked in a diner, like some guys would come with their fork and try to stab Jim because he had long hair and a beard. We also wanted to represent some aspect of this unknown, unknowable culture. So the sound for Viet Flakes takes images from European magazines because states are repressing the atrocity images. And we begin to find Vietnamese music, songs and chants, so that the sound can incorporate something that's theirs, even though we don't know if we're interposing it proportionately, but we want that aspect of their culture. Mm-hmm. And I've gathered all these photographs, and that work still upsets me, really upsets me. I never stopped feeling, even today, what I felt when I put that work together. So I was sitting in the loft in New York City with all these atrocity photograph prints. And you know the story. I had borrowed a camera and didn't have a close-up lens. I had only this day when I had to compose the images. And I was in New York City, and we still had the 5 and 10. Did you have them here?
No, well, I'm not sure. What's the 5 and 10? Maybe explain, yeah.
Oh, we had them for 100 years. It was a big store where you could get everything for more or less under a dollar.
Oh, is that what they used to call the 5 and dime?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Okay, yeah. You could get slippers and towels. And anyway, they had these little lenses that old people used to enlarge their reading material. Mm. So I got a bunch of them. So that film is made with me, my shifting these funky little lenses over the existing lens.
And I wanted to ask you a bit about, well, the internet. Now, that's caused, so the internet has caused a huge change in visual culture. And in some ways that was presaged. Some of the stuff that we're seeing produced after the web, say, almost seems to be presaged by stuff that you were doing in, say, pieces like Devour.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, has it had any effect on the work that you're making now that there's this huge suppository of images, repository of images, not suppository.
Yes, it's both, absolutely. It comes out both ends. Yeah. I'm not sure which ends it's going in, but don't edit that out. It's perfect.
So, yeah, I mean, how do you feel about it? Do you use it? I mean,
I don't have a regular TV, and I miss that when there's some disaster. But I have, I compose. I compose all these multi-channel video works. What I found on my computer, I don't know if you know them. Do you know Key and Peele?
No.
No. No, they make me so happy to be an American. It's two black guys from Detroit. And they're geniuses, and there's no aspect of culture that they cannot enter and subvert. They're so inspiring to me. You know, you can see how happy I am just to mention Key and Peele. They do work, they have one work. They come out of Comedy Central, and so they've been building this huge body of performed events, I guess you could call it. They've just done one on the clitoris. That's outrageous. They're dressed like crazy people. They have 1,000 wigs. They have these great big odd-looking wigs, and they're wearing like green and yellow and plaid clothes, and they're speaking so fast that you can hardly anybody understand them. But at some point, they're trying to explain what is this clitoris, and it's always Peele who's sort of the more knowledgeable one, who says, well, it's like a penis with 1,000 endings. And I love the one that is called Cute Puppy. You must look that up. They do it in drag as California girls. They have long nails and these wigs and these ridiculous gestures and outfits, and they pass a pet shop and there's an adorable little puppy in it. And they say, oh, my God, look at that, isn't that? Oh, I love it so much. It's so cute. Don't you want to put its little nose on your bedroom slippers? Yes, and we cut its head off, and we make a, you know, they go on about how to destroy this most precious thing.
And what are they called again? Key?
They're two names, K-E-Y, Key, and P-E-E-L-E.
Yeah.
Very suggestive, perfect names. They're two black guys from, I think, Detroit, who have, there is no shibboleth. They do not want to attack and turn inside out. So they're very Freudian, but in such a subtle and yet powerful way. You don't have to know anything about psychological history to be completely drawn in.
And what about your relationship to, say, YouTube? Do you ever go on there and just sort of have a random surf and see what videos are out there, or?
Yeah, I go there to see who's been ripping off my films. And
I want to ask you about that, because particularly with a film like Fuses. Now that's sort of online, and you think, well, in one sense you've made the work in one way, and then people may be viewing it in another way via this. And how do you feel in reference to that? I mean,
it's a YouTube nightmare. You can't control it, or you can try. There are ways that there are legal authorities that can interfere, but they cost a fortune. It's its own communication chaos. I don't think there's anything I can do about it. I find things on it now and then. I don't have Twitter. I don't have all those communication toys. I hate my cell phone, and I detest typing on my computer.
So that gives me an answer in relation to how are you feeling in terms of the sort of information technology revolution and the saturation of our lives of information technology.
Yes, as soon as you say that, I want to sit in the mud and sort some pebbles.
But despite that, I mean, you're not a Luddite. I mean, you
I work with extreme technologies whenever I can, but they have to be on my terms.
And can we talk a bit about More Wrong Things?
Yes, then? Please. Yes.
So explain that. Talk me. I suppose this is a great opportunity to get you to just talk through the project, because I haven't seen it, and I'm thinking maybe obviously the listeners might not have seen the work.
No.
And because it's radio, it lends itself to description. So maybe talk a bit about the form and the content. Maybe what led to the work in the first place.
It was probably about 10 or 11 years ago, people I didn't know began sending me fragments of their disaster films. Remarkable, overwhelming, disturbing fragments from a Sarajevo co-op in which they had a line saying, this is our last possible communication. We want people to know what's happening here. And it was a film of incredibly various kinds of destruction. So I had that. And then people working in Haiti sent me images of the police beating people. And anyway, all this material suddenly started to accumulate, and I really wanted to work with it. But what form could I give to such a variety of spontaneous disaster materials? And I began to edit it, and I loved working with it. Some extraordinary material that I could never use. The war criminal from former Yugoslavia who describes murdering, raping and murdering a young woman from their village. He's so compelling, he could be a complete film, but he's just part of what's passing through. And then I was offered a space, again with no money, a nice, eccentric, large gallery in Chelsea. And I loved the space, and I wanted to build for it, and I realized I needed something like 16 to 20 old monitors that I would suspend from a network of cables and ropes and wires from the ceiling and build a sort of network of webbery and suspend the monitors on which I would have edited all the sequences that could go projected not in sequence or occurring on the monitors. They would be audience activated as viewers walked by. The images would appear before them. And there was this wonderful cacophony of found sound in it. So it's very hard to... I found it very organized to get all this wire and ropes and the monitors, but it was recently shown in this beautiful medieval castle in France, Rochechouart. And the curator had everything perfectly installed when I got there. I was astonished. You know, I had my work boots on. I was prepared to redo everything. Oh, it was wonderful. So, because they have to hang at a certain height and with a density. And the sound is wonderful. It's all these fragments of... they're subtle, but certain cries and yells and explosions. And then in the next section of the castle was my relatively recent installation, multi-channel installation, Precarious. That's a work that began with studying brutality to animals. And that started because I was working in Montreal, and they had newspapers there from China, and in one of the newspapers were these cages filled with the most beautiful cats. They looked like everybody's pets. And they were squished in these open cages, and they were going to be turned into soup.
Wow.
Yeah, well, they eat cats there. And then, you know, I researched people who train katydids to attack each other, who alter normal behavior by introducing competition or crisis. And then as a countermeasure to that, I found Snowball, which is a play on my name. Snowball, the dancing cockatoo. Have you seen him? It's a he.
No.
Famous, famous bird, because this cockatoo adjusts his rhythms to any music that's played. And he listens and he waits. And it's rock and roll. He's got this beat. And then if it's silent night, he slows down and all his feathers slow. So he would be a work on his own, but I wanted him as part of Dancing in Captivity. So Precarious is all about dancing in captivity. There's prisoners from Panama in their, I mean from the Philippines in their orange uniforms. Their discipline is to dance. And they're trained to dance in these amazing precise configurations. There's a bear on a chain. I didn't know it at the time. I found it on YouTube, great for research. It's actually from an Eisenstein film. So I composed this intensive multi-channel captivity work. And it was one of my rare commissions. It was for the Tate and Liverpool
And so we're coming towards the end of the interview now, and so I kind of want to just open out and ask you a bit about the future. What do you have in the bag? What are you thinking about at the moment? What issues are kind of pertinent to you presently?
Well, the future is very shrouded in loss. It's my age group. You know, I'm back in London with such intense affiliations and associations, and most of my friends are dead or I can't find them. So the future is that increasing pattern and my own frailties. I'm very concerned for my old house, the house where I filmed Fuses in 64, 63, the house I returned to after my years in London. It is a remarkable entity, and then there's all the work. So the future is very shadowy, and then there's one incredible, insane war after another. I looked at the video here, because that's what I can do in a hotel. I'm in a lovely room, I put on the video. These men are just stabbing, killing, setting themselves on fire, change the sat channel. They're blowing everything up, change the channel. They're choking each other to death, change the channel. Well, that's such an intensity of the present. With the counterforce of different kinds of integrations and the wonderful food in London, will this sustain itself for the future? The rare new authority for genders and races here. We didn't used to have that even 15 years ago. The dreadful new buses, is this the future? How they slick everything up to make it worse and less humane.
That's a kind of bleak panorama of what we can look forward to.
You mean next week?
Yeah. But what
I'm busy. I have several books that I'm working on. I'm trying to finish my cat book. I'm underway for a major compendium with Black Dog here in London. There's a very exciting intensive exhibit planned for Salzburg, the museum there, and the director is Sabine Breitfester.
I think actually it was good to hear like the two depictions. But I'm also wondering, like, what place do you feel feminism has in combating what might be quite a bleak future?
Well, feminism is always fragile in all its ferocity and deepened transformations. We can't go back from feminism. Feminism in analyzing everything, biology, science, archaeology, linguistics, gender politics. But the forces, reactionary forces, they do not subdue. They turn up all over again. Crazy Arizona has passed a law so that any sort of abortion work at all will be a criminal offense. The resistance to the principles of equity and self-determination seem to provoke fierce hyper-masculine responses. So there's more surveillance, there's more weird weapons that we don't know what they're really doing. There's more configurations of disruptions and contentions in places that you wouldn't think they continue to be. So there's religious fighting and racial fighting and fighting over materials that give power to governments. We have critical ecological problems. They're only going to increase. Who's going to win for the water, for the oil, for the air? What was the question? What am I doing or what's happening?
No, that's the problem. There's a litany of things that need to be fixed. And it's just saying the energy that feminism has, in what way can that be used to combat some of this stuff that's happening?
Well, it's definitely combating or transforming education, policies of education, where this is possible. Where this is not possible, education is becoming diabolical, repressing really crucial parts of history. Mm-hmm. And So it's like watching these evil mushrooms come up. We think they're gone, and they have a whole new fertility and purposeful, murderous energy.
Speaking of fertility, so just bring it back to the show. I think, to me, this is a kind of a sanctuary of positivity amongst some of the negative things that we've been putting out. So, I just want to stress to listeners that they should come to Hale's Gallery and take a look at the show.
It's a beautiful exhibit, and it's very fresh and unique in its presentation.
Brilliant. Carolee Schneemann, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much.